Chapter 16 Darya Alexandrovna carried out her intention and went to see Anna. She was sorry to annoy her sister and to do anything Levin disliked. She quite understood how right the Levins were in not wishing to have anything to do with Vronsky, but she felt she must go and see Anna and show her that her feelings couldn't be changed in spite of the change in her position. That she might be independent of the Levins in this expedition, Darya Alexandrovna sent to the village to hire horses for the drive, but Levin, learning of it, went to her to protest. "What makes you suppose that I dislike your going? But even if I did dislike it, I would still more dislike your not taking my horses," he said. "You never told me that you were going for certain. Hiring horses in the village is distasteful to me, and what's more important, they'll undertake the job and never get you there. I have horses. And if you don't want to hurt me, you'll take mine." Darya Alexandrovna had to consent, and on the day fixed, Levin had ready for his sister-in-law a set of 4 horses and a change of horses waiting at the post station, getting them together from the farm, and saddle horses, not at all a smart-looking set, but capable of taking Darya Alexandrovna the whole distance in a single day. At that moment, when horses were needed for both the princess and the midwife, it was a difficult matter for Levin to decide on the number, but the duties of hospitality wouldn't let him allow Darya Alexandrovna to hire horses when staying in his house. Moreover, he was well aware that the 20 roubles that would be asked for the journey was a serious matter for her. Darya Alexandrovna's financial affairs, which were in a very unsatisfactory state, were taken to heart by the Levins as if they were their own. Darya Alexandrovna, on Levin's advice, started before daybreak. The road was good, the carriage comfortable, and the horses trotted along merrily, and on the box, beside the coachman, sat the office clerk, whom Levin was sending instead of a groom for greater security. Darya Alexandrovna dozed, and waked only on reaching the inn where the horses were to be changed. After drinking tea at the same well-to-do peasants with whom Levin had stayed on the way to Shevasky's, and chatting with the women about their children, and with the old man about Count Vronsky, whom the latter praised very highly, Darya Alexandrovna, at 10 o'clock, went on again. At home, looking after her children, she had no time to think. So now, after this journey of 4 hours, all the thoughts she had suppressed before rushed swarming into her brain, and she thought over her whole life as she never had before, and from the most different points of view. Her thoughts seemed strange even to herself. At first, she thought about the children, about whom she was uneasy, although the princess and Kitty, she counted more upon her, had promised to look after them. "If only Masha doesn't start up with her naughty tricks, if Grisha isn't kicked by a horse, and Lily's stomach isn't upset again," she thought. But these questions of the present were replaced by questions of the immediate future. She began thinking about how she had to get a new apartment in Moscow for the coming winter, reupholster the drawing-room furniture, and make her elder girl a cloak. Then questions of the more remote future occurred to her. How she was to place her children in the world. The girls are all right, she thought, but the boys. "It's very well that I'm teaching Grisha, but of course that's only because I'm free myself now. I'm not with child. Steva, of course, there's no counting on. And with the help of kind friends, I can bring them up. But if there's another baby coming..." And the thought struck her how untruly it was said that the curse laid on woman was that in sorrow she should bring forth children. The birth itself, that's nothing. But the months of carrying the child, that's what's so intolerable, she thought, picturing to herself her last pregnancy and the death of the last baby. And she recalled the conversation she had just had with the young woman at the inn. On being asked whether she had any children, the handsome young woman had answered cheerfully, "I had a baby girl, but God set me free. I buried her last Lent." "Well, did you grieve very much for her?" asked Darya Alexandrovna. "Why grieve? The old man has grandchildren enough as it is. It was only trouble. No working, no anything, only tied hand and foot." This answer had struck Darya Alexandrovna as revolting, in spite of the good-natured and pleasing face of the young woman. But now she couldn't help recalling those words. In those cynical words, there was indeed a grain of truth. Yes, altogether, thought Darya Alexandrovna, looking back over her whole existence during those 15 years of her married life. Pregnancy, sickness, dullness of mind, indifference to everything, and most of all, disfigurement. Kitty, young and pretty as she is, even Kitty has lost her looks. And I, when I'm with child, become hideous, I know it. The birth, the agony, the hideous agonies, that last moment. Then the nursing, the sleepless nights, the fearful pains. Darya Alexandrovna shuddered at the mere recollection of the pain from sore nipples which she had suffered with almost every child. Then the children's illnesses, that everlasting apprehension. Then bringing them up. Evil propensities. She thought of little Masha's crime among the raspberries. Education. Latin. It's all so incomprehensible and difficult. And on top of it all, the death of these children. And there rose again before her imagination the cruel memory which always tore her mother's heart, of the death of her last little baby, who had died of croup, his funeral, the callous indifference of all at the little pink coffin and her own torn heart, and her lonely anguish at the sight of the pale little brow fringed with curls, and the open, surprised little mouth seen in the coffin at the moment when it was being covered with the little pink lid with a cross braided on it. And all this, what's it for? What is to become of it all? That I'm wasting my life, never having a moment's peace either with child or nursing a child, forever irritable, peevish, wretched myself and worrying others, repulsive to my husband, while the children are growing up unhappy, badly educated, and utterly poor. Even now, if it weren't for spending the summer at the Levins, I don't know how we would be managing to live. Of course, Kostya and Kitty have so much tact that we don't feel it. But it can't go on. They'll have children. They won't be able to keep us. It's a drag on them as it is. How is Papa, who has hardly anything left for himself, to help us? So that I can't even bring the children up by myself, and may find it hard with the help of other people, at the cost of humiliation. Why, even if we suppose the greatest good luck that the children don't die, and I bring them up somehow, at the very best they'll simply be decent people, and that's all I can hope for. And to gain simply that, what agonies, what toil! One's whole life ruined. Again she recalled what the young peasant woman had said, and again she was revolted at the thought. But she couldn't help admitting that there was a grain of brutal truth in the words. "Is it far now, Mikhail?" Darya Alexandrovna asked the office clerk to turn her mind from thoughts that were frightening her. "From this village they say it's 5 miles." The carriage drove along the village street and onto a bridge. On the bridge was a crowd of peasant women with ready twisted sheaf-binders on their shoulders, gaily and noisily chattering. They stood still on the bridge, staring inquisitively at the carriage. All the faces turned to Darya Alexandrovna looked to her healthy and happy, making her envious of their enjoyment of life. They're all living. They're all enjoying life. Darya Alexandrovna still mused when she had passed the peasant women and was driving uphill again at a trot, seated comfortably on the soft springs of the old carriage. While I, let out, as it were, from prison, from the world of worries that fret me to death, am only looking about me now for an instant. They all live, those peasant women, and my sister Natalie, and Varenka, and Anna, whom I'm going to see, all, but not I. And they attack Anna. What for? Am I any better? I have, anyway, a husband I love, though as I would like to love him, still I do love him, while Anna never loved hers. How is she to blame? She wants to live. God has put that in our hearts. Very likely I should have done the same. Even to this day I don't feel sure I did right in listening to her at that terrible time when she came to me in Moscow. I ought then to have cast off my husband and have been loved the real way. And is it any better as it is? I don't respect him. He's necessary to me. She thought about her husband. And I put up with him. Is that any better? At that time I could still have been admired. I had beauty left me. Darya Alexandrovna pursued her thoughts, and felt a sudden desire to look at herself in a mirror. She had a travelling mirror in her handbag, and she wanted to take it out. But looking at the backs of the coachman and the swaying office clerk, she felt that she would be ashamed if either of them were to look around, and she didn't take out the mirror. But without looking in the mirror, she thought that even now it wasn't too late, and she thought of Sergei Ivanovitch, who was always particularly attentive to her, of Stiva's good-hearted friend Turovtsin, who had helped her nurse her children through scarlet fever, and was in love with her. And there was someone else, a quite young man who, her husband had told her as a joke, thought her more beautiful than either of her sisters. And the most passionate and impossible romances rose before Darya Alexandrovna's imagination. Anna did quite right, and certainly I shall never reproach her for it. She's happy. She makes another person happy, and she's not broken down as I am, but most likely just as she always was, bright, clever, open to every impression, thought Darya Alexandrovna. And a sly smile curved her lips, for, as she pondered on Anna's love affair, Darya Alexandrovna constructed on parallel lines an almost identical love affair for herself, with an imaginary composite figure, the ideal man who was in love with her. She, like Anna, confessed the whole affair to her husband, and the amazement and perplexity of Stepan Arkadyevitch at this avowal made her smile. Wrapped in such daydreams, she reached the turning leading from the high road to Vozdvizhenskoye. Chapter 17. The coachman pulled up his four horses and looked around to the right, to a field of rye where some peasants were sitting on a cart. The office clerk was just going to jump down, but on second thought he shouted peremptorily to the peasants instead and beckoned them to come up. The wind, which seemed to blow as they drove, dropped when the carriage stood still. Gadflies settled on the steaming horses, which angrily tried to shake them off. The metallic clank of a whetstone against a scythe which came to them from the cart ceased. One of the peasants got up and came toward the carriage.
"Well, get a move on!"
the clerk shouted angrily to the peasant, who was stepping slowly with his bare feet over the ruts of the rough, dry road.
"Hurry up! Hurry!"
A curly-headed old man, with a bit of bast tied around his hair and his bent back dark with perspiration, came toward the carriage, quickening his steps, and put his sunburned arm on the mudguard.
"Vozdvizhenskoye, the manor house, the Count's," he repeated.
"Go on to the end of this track, then turn to the left, straight along the avenue, and you'll come right upon it. But whom do you want, the Count himself?"
"Well, are they at home, my good man?"
Darya Alexandrovna said vaguely, not knowing how to ask about Anna, even of this peasant.
"At home for sure," said the peasant, shifting from one bare foot to the other, and leaving a distinct print of five toes and a heel in the dust. "Sure to be at home," he repeated, evidently eager to talk. "Yesterday more visitors arrived. There's a lot of visitors come. What do you want?"
He turned around and called to a boy who was shouting something to him from the cart.
"Oh, they all rode by here not long since to look at the reaper. They'll be home by now. And who may you be?"
"We've come a long way," said the coachman, climbing onto the box. "So it's not far?"
"I tell you, it's just here. As soon as you get out," he said, keeping hold all the while of the carriage.
A healthy-looking, broad-shouldered young fellow came up too.
"Isn't there some work for the harvest?" he asked. "I wouldn't know, my boy."
"So you keep to the left, and you'll come right on it," said the peasant,
unmistakably loath to let the travellers go, and eager to converse. The coachman started the horses, but they were only just turning when the peasant shouted,
"Stop! Hey, friend, stop!"
called the two voices. The coachman stopped.
"They're coming! They're yonder!" shouted the peasant. "See? What a turnout!" he said,
pointing to four persons on horseback and two in a charabanc coming along the road. They were Vronsky with a jockey, Veslovsky and Anna on horseback,
and Princess Varvara and Schiavaski in the Sharabang. They'd gone out to look at the operation of newly arrived reapers. When the carriage stopped, the party on horseback were coming at a walking pace. Anna was in front beside Veslovsky, Anna quietly riding her horse, a sturdy English cob with a cropped mane and short tail. Anna's beautiful head, with her black curls straying from under her top hat, her full shoulders, her slender waist in her black riding habit, and all the ease and grace of her deportment, struck Dolly. For the first minute, it seemed to her unsuitable for Anna to be on horseback. The conception of riding on horseback for a lady was, in Darya Alexandrovna's mind, associated with ideas of youthful flirtation and frivolity, which, in her opinion, was unbecoming in Anna's position. But when she had scrutinized her, seeing her closer, she was at once reconciled to her riding. In spite of her elegance, everything was so simple, quiet, and dignified in the attitude, the dress, and the movements of Anna that nothing could have been more natural. Beside Anna, on a steaming grey cavalry horse, was Vasenka Veslovsky, in his Scotch cap with floating ribbons, his stout legs stretched out in front, obviously pleased with his own appearance. Darya Alexandrovna couldn't suppress a good-humoured smile as she recognised him. Behind rode Vronsky on a dark bay mare, obviously heated from galloping. He was holding her in, pulling at the reins. After him rode a little man in the costume of a jockey. Anna's face suddenly beamed with a joyful smile at the instant when, in the little figure huddled in a corner of the old carriage, she recognised Dolly. She uttered a cry, started in the saddle, and set her horse into a gallop. On reaching the carriage, she jumped off without assistance, and holding up her riding habit, she ran up to greet Dolly. "I thought it was you, and dared not think it. How delightful! You can't imagine how glad I am," she said, at one moment pressing her face against Dolly and kissing her, and at the next holding her off and examining her with a smile. "Here's a delightful surprise, Alexei," she said, looking round at Vronsky, who had dismounted and was walking toward them. Vronsky, taking off his grey top hat, went up to Dolly.
"You wouldn't believe how glad we are to see you," he said, giving peculiar significance to the words, and showing his strong white teeth in a smile. Vasenka Veslovsky, without getting off his horse, took off his cap and greeted the visitor by gleefully waving the ribbons over his head.
"That's Princess Varvara," Anna said in reply to a glance of inquiry from Dolly as the Sharabang drove up. "Ah," said Darya Alexandrovna, and unconsciously her face betrayed her dissatisfaction. Princess Varvara was her husband's aunt, and she had long known her and didn't respect her. She knew that Princess Varvara had passed her whole life toadying on her rich relations, but that she should now be sponging on Vronsky, a man who was nothing to her, mortified Dolly on account of her kinship with her husband. Anna noticed Dolly's expression and was disconcerted by it. She blushed, dropped her riding habit, and stumbled over it. Darya Alexandrovna went up to the Sharabang and coldly greeted Princess Varvara.
Schiavaski, too, she knew. He inquired how his strange friend with the young wife was, and running his eyes over the ill-matched horses and the carriage with its patched mudguards, proposed to the ladies that they should get into the Sharabang. "And I'll get into this vehicle," he said. "The horse is quiet, and the princess drives very well."
"No, stay as you were," said Anna, coming up,
"and we'll go in the carriage."
And taking Dolly's arm, she drew her away. Darya Alexandrovna's eyes were fairly dazzled by the elegant carriage of a kind she'd never seen before, the splendid horses, and the elegant and gorgeous people surrounding her. But what struck her most of all was the change that had taken place in Anna, whom she knew so well and loved. Any other woman, a less close observer, not knowing Anna before, or not having thought as Darya Alexandrovna had been thinking on the road, wouldn't have noticed anything special in Anna. But now Dolly was struck by the temporary beauty which is found in women only during the moments of love, and which she now saw in Anna's face. Everything in her face, the clearly marked dimples in her cheeks and chin, the line of her lips, the smile which, as it were, fluttered about her face, the brilliance of her eyes, the grace and rapidity of her movements,
the fullness of the notes of her voice, even the manner in which, with a sort of angry friendliness, she answered Veslovsky when he asked permission to get on her cob so as to teach it to gallop with the right leg foremost, it was all peculiarly fascinating. And it seemed as if she were herself aware of it and rejoicing in it. When both the women were seated in the carriage, a sudden embarrassment came over both of them. Anna was disconcerted by the intent look of inquiry Dolly fixed upon her. Dolly was embarrassed, because after Shiavasky's phrase about this vehicle, she couldn't help feeling ashamed of the dirty old carriage in which Anna was sitting with her. The coachman Philippe and the office clerk were experiencing the same sensation. The clerk, to conceal his confusion, busied himself settling the ladies. But Philippe the coachman became sullen, and was bracing himself not to be overawed in the future by this show of superiority. He smiled ironically, looking at the raven horse, and was already deciding in his own mind that this smart trotter in the charabang was good only for promenage, and wouldn't do 30 miles in a stretch in the heat. The peasants had all got up from the cart, and were inquisitively and mirthfully staring at the meeting of the friends, making their comments on it.
"They're pleased, too. Haven't seen each other for a long while," said the curly-headed old man with a bast around his hair. "Hey, Uncle Gerasim, if we could take that raven horse now to cart the corn, that'd be quick work." "Looky, is that a woman in breeches?"
said one of them, pointing to Vasenka Veslovsky, sitting side-saddle.
"Nay, a man. See how easily he jumped up. Hey, lads, seems we're not going to sleep, then." "What chance of sleep today?"
said the old man, with a sidelong look at the sun.
"Midday's past, looky. Get your hooks and come along."
Chapter 18. Anna looked at Dolly's thin, careworn face, with its wrinkles filled with dust from the road, and she was on the point of saying what she was thinking, that is, that Dolly had got thinner. But conscious that her looks had improved, and that Dolly's eyes were telling her so, she sighed and began to speak about herself.
"You're looking at me," she said, "and wondering how I can be happy in my position. Well, it's shameful to confess, but I'm inexcusably happy. Something magical has happened to me, like a dream, when you wake up and all the horrors are no more. I have waked up. I've lived through the misery, the dread, and now for a long while past, especially since we've been here, I've been so happy."
"How glad I am," said Dolly, smiling, involuntarily speaking more coldly than she wanted to. "I'm very glad for you. Why haven't you written to me?"
"Why?"
"Because I hadn't the courage. You forget my position."
"To me, hadn't the courage. If you knew how I look at—"
Darya Alexandrovna wanted to express her thoughts of the morning, but for some reason it seemed to her now out of place to do so.
"But of that we'll talk later. What's this? What are all these buildings?" she asked, wanting to change the conversation, and pointing to the red and green roofs that came into view behind the green hedges of acacia and lilac. "Quite a little town."
But Anna didn't answer.
"No, no. How do you look at my position? What do you think of it?" she asked.
"I think," Darya Alexandrovna was beginning. But at that instant, Vasenka Veslovsky, having brought the cob to gallop with the right leg foremost, galloped past them in his short jacket, bumping heavily up and down on the chamois leather of the side-saddle.
"He's doing it, Anna Arkadyevna!" he shouted.
Anna didn't even glance at him. But again, it seemed to Darya Alexandrovna out of place to enter upon such a long conversation in the carriage, and so she cut short her thought.
"I don't think anything," she said. "But I always loved you, and if one loves anyone, one loves the whole person just as they are, and not as one would like them to be."
Anna, taking her eyes off her friend's face and lowering her eyelids, a new habit with her, pondered, trying to penetrate the full significance of the words. And obviously interpreting them as she would have wished, she glanced at Dolly.
"If you have any sins," she said, "they would all be forgiven you for your coming to see me and for these words."
And Dolly saw that the tears stood in her eyes.
She pressed Anna's hand in silence.
"Well, what are these buildings? How many there are of them?"
After a moment's silence, she repeated her question.
"These are the servants' houses, barns, and stables," answered Anna. "And there the park begins." It had all gone to ruin, but Alexei had everything renewed. He's very fond of this place, and what I never expected, he has become intensely interested in looking after it. But his is such an endowed nature. Whatever he takes up, he does splendidly. He's not only not bored, but he works with passionate interest. He, with his temperament as I know it, he has become careful and businesslike, a first-rate landlord. He absolutely counts every kopeck in his management of the land. But only in that. When it's a question of tens of thousands, he doesn't think of money.
She spoke with that gleefully sly smile with which women often talk of the secret characteristics known only to them of those they love.
"Do you see that big building? That's the new hospital. I believe it will cost over 100,000. That's his hobby just now. And you know how it all came about? The peasants asked him for some meadowland. I think it was at a cheaper rate, and he refused, and I accused him of being miserly. Of course, it wasn't really because of that, but everything together he began this hospital to prove, do you see, that he wasn't miserly about money. C'est une petitesse, if you like, but I love him all the more for it. And now you'll see the house in a moment. It was his grandfather's house, and he has had nothing altered outside." "How beautiful," said Dolly, looking with involuntary admiration at the handsome house with columns standing out among the different coloured greens of the old trees in the garden. "Isn't it fine? And from the house, from the top, the view is wonderful."
They drove into a courtyard strewn with gravel and bright with flowers, in which two labourers were at work putting a border of stones around the light mould of a flower-bed, and drew up in a covered entry.
"Oh, they're here already," said Anna, looking at the horses, which were just being led away from the steps. "It's a nice horse, isn't it? It's my cob, my favourite. Lead him here and bring me some sugar." "Where's the Count?" she inquired of two footmen, in impeccable livery, who darted out. "Oh, there he is," she said, seeing Vronsky coming to meet her with Veslovsky. "Where are you going to put the princess?" said Vronsky in French, addressing Anna. And without waiting for a reply, he once more greeted Darya Alexandrovna, and this time he kissed her hand.
"I think the large balcony room."
"Oh, no, that's too far off. Better in the corner room. We shall see each other more. Come, let's go up," said Anna, as she gave her favourite horse the sugar the footman had brought her.
"Et vous oubliez votre devoir?" she said to Veslovsky,
who also came out on the steps.
"Pardon? J'en ai tout plein les poches," he answered, smiling, putting his fingers in his vest pocket. "Mais vous venez trop tard," she said, rubbing her handkerchief on her hand, which the horse had made wet in taking the sugar.
Anna turned to Dolly.
"You can stay some time. For one day only? That's impossible." "I promise to be back. And the children," said Dolly, feeling embarrassed both because she had to get her bag out of the carriage and because she knew her face must be covered with dust. "No, Dolly, darling. Well, we'll see. Come along, come along." And Anna led Dolly to her room.
The room wasn't the grand guest room Vronsky had suggested, but the one for which Anna apologized to Dolly. And this room, for which apology seemed necessary, was more luxurious than any in which Dolly had ever stayed, so luxurious that it reminded her of the best hotels abroad.
"Well, darling, how happy I am," Anna said, sitting down in her riding habit for a moment beside Dolly. "Tell me about all of you."
"Stiva I had only a glimpse of, and he cannot tell one about the children. How's my favourite, Tanya? Quite a big girl, I expect."
"Yes, she is very tall,"
Darya Alexandrovna answered shortly, surprised herself that she should respond so coldly about her children.
"We are having a delightful stay at the Levins," she added. "Oh, if I'd only known," said Anna, "that you don't despise me. You might have all come to us. Steve is an old friend, and a great friend of Alexei's, you know," she added,
and suddenly she blushed.
Yes, but we are all... Dolly answered in confusion. But in my delight I'm talking nonsense. The one thing, darling, is that I'm so glad to have you, said Anna, kissing her again. You haven't told me yet how and what you think about me, and I keep wanting to know. But I'm glad you'll see me as I am. Above all, I wouldn't want people to think that I want to prove anything. I don't want to prove anything. I merely want to live, to do no one harm but myself. I've the right to do that, haven't I? But it's a big subject, and we'll talk over everything properly later. Now I'll go and dress and send a maid to you.
Chapter 19. Left alone, Darya Alexandrovna, with an experienced housewife's eye, surveyed her room. All she had seen in entering the house and walking through it, and all she saw now in her room, gave her an impression of wealth and sumptuousness, and of that modern European luxury of which she had only read in English novels, but had never seen in Russia and in the country. Everything was new, from the new French wallpaper to the carpet that covered the whole floor. The bed had a spring mattress and a special sort of bolster, and silk covers were on the little pillows. The marble washstand, the dressing table, the little sofa, the tables, the bronze clock on the mantelpiece, the window curtains, and the door hangings were all new and expensive. The smartly dressed maid who came in to offer her services, with her hair done up more stylishly than Dolly's, and more fashionably dressed, was as new and expensive as the whole room. Darya Alexandrovna liked her neatness, her deferential and obliging manners, but she felt ill at ease with her. She felt ashamed of her seeing the patched bed jacket that had unfortunately been packed by mistake for her. She was ashamed of the very patches and darns of which she'd been so proud at home. At home it had been so clear that 6 bed jackets required 18 yards of nainsook at 65 kopecks a yard, which was a matter of more than 15 roubles besides the trimmings, and the work and this money had been saved. But before the maid she felt, if not exactly ashamed, at least uncomfortable. Darya Alexandrovna had a great sense of relief when Anushka, whom she'd known for years, walked in. The smartly dressed maid was sent for to go to her mistress, and Anushka remained with Darya Alexandrovna. Anushka was obviously much pleased at that lady's arrival, and began to chatter away without a pause. Dolly observed that she was longing to express her opinion in regard to her mistress's position, especially as to the love and devotion of the Count to Anna Arkadyevna, but Dolly carefully interrupted her whenever she began to speak about this.
"I grew up with Anna Arkadyevna. My lady's dearer to me than anything. Well, it's not for us to judge, and to be sure there seems so much love. Kindly pour out the water for me to wash now, please," Darya Alexandrovna cut her short. "Certainly. We've 2 women kept specially for washing small things, but most of the linen's done by machinery. The Count goes into everything himself. Oh, what a husband!"
Dolly was glad when Anna came in and by her entrance put a stop to Anushka's gossip. Anna had put on a very simple batiste dress. Dolly scrutinized that simple dress attentively. She knew what it meant, and the price at which such simplicity was obtained.
"An old friend," said Anna of Anushka.
Anna was not embarrassed now. She was perfectly composed and at ease. Dolly saw that she had now completely recovered from that embarrassment her arrival had caused her, and had assumed that superficial, careless tone which, as it were, closed the door on that compartment in which her deeper feelings and ideas were kept.
"Well, Anna, and how is your little girl?" asked Dolly.
"Annie," this was what she called her little daughter, Anna.
"Very well. She's done wonderfully. Would you like to see her? Come, I'll show her to you." "We had a great deal of trouble," she began telling her, "over nurses. We had an Italian wet nurse, a good creature, but so stupid. We wanted to get rid of her, but the baby is so used to her that we've gone on keeping her."
"But how have you managed—" Dolly was about to ask what name the little girl would have, but noticing a sudden frown on Anna's face, she changed the drift of her question.
"How did you manage? Have you weaned her yet?"
But Anna had understood.
"You didn't mean to ask that. You meant to ask about her surname, yes?"
That worries Alexei. She has no name, that is, she's a Karenina, said Anna, lowering her eyelids till nothing could be seen but the eyelashes meeting. But we'll talk about all that later, she said, her face suddenly brightening. Come see her. Elle est très gentille. She crawls now. In the nursery, the luxury which had impressed Dolly in the whole house struck her still more. There were little carts ordered from England, and appliances for teaching babies to walk, and a sofa, after the fashion of a billiard table, purposely constructed for crawling, and swings and baths, all of special pattern and modern. They were all English, solid, and of good make, and obviously very expensive. The room was large and very light and airy. When they went in, the baby, with nothing on but her little smock, was sitting in a little armchair at the table, having her dinner of broth, which she was spilling all over her little chest. The baby was being fed, and the Russian nursemaid was evidently sharing her meal. Neither the wet nurse nor the head nurse were there. They were in the next room, from which came the sound of their conversation in the peculiar French that was their only means of communication. Hearing Anna's voice, a tall, smartly dressed English nurse with a disagreeable face and a coarse expression, walked in at the door, hurriedly shaking her fair curls, and immediately began to defend herself, though Anna hadn't found fault with her. At every word Anna said, the English nurse said hurriedly several times, "Yes, my lady." The rosy-faced baby with her black eyebrows and hair, her sturdy red little body covered with goose-flesh, delighted Darya Alexandrovna, in spite of the cross expression with which she stared at the stranger. She positively envied the baby's healthy appearance. She was delighted, too, at the baby's crawling. Not one of her own children had crawled like that. When the baby was put on the carpet and its little dress tucked up behind, it was wonderfully charming. Looking around like some wild little animal at the grown-up people with her bright black eyes, she smiled, unmistakably pleased at their admiring her. And holding her legs sideways, she pressed vigorously on her arms and rapidly drew her whole back up after, and then made another step forward with her little arms. But the whole atmosphere of the nursery, and especially the English nurse, Darya Alexandrovna, didn't like at all. It was only on the supposition that no good nurse would have entered so irregular a household as Anna's that Darya Alexandrovna could explain to herself how Anna, with her insight into people, could take such an unprepossessing, disreputable-looking woman as nurse to her child. Besides, from a few words that were dropped, Darya Alexandrovna saw at once that Anna, the two nurses, and the child had no common existence, and that the mother's visit was something exceptional. Anna wanted to get the baby one of her toys, but couldn't find it. Most amazing of all was the fact that on being asked how many teeth the baby had, Anna answered incorrectly, and knew nothing about the two last teeth.
"I sometimes feel sorry I'm so superfluous here," said Anna, going out of the nursery, and holding up her skirt so as to escape the playthings standing in the doorway. "It was very different with my first child." "I expected it to be the other way," said Darya Alexandrovna shyly. "Oh, no!" "By the way, do you know I saw Seryozha?" said Anna, screwing up her eyes as though looking at something far away. "But we'll talk about that later. You wouldn't believe it. I'm like a hungry beggar woman when a full dinner is set before her, and she doesn't know what to begin with first. The dinner is you, and the talks we're going to have together, which I could never have with anyone else, and I don't know which subject to begin with first. Mais je ne vous ferai grâce de rien. I must have everything out with you. Oh, I ought to give you an idea of the company you will meet with us," she began. "I'll begin with the ladies. Princess Varvara, you know her, and I know your opinion and Stiva's about her. Stiva says the whole aim of her existence is to prove her superiority over Auntie Katerina Pavlovna. Well, that's all true, but she's a good-natured woman, and I'm so grateful to her. In Petersburg, there was a moment when a chaperone was absolutely essential for me. Then she turned up. But really, she is good-natured. She did a great deal to alleviate my situation. I can see you don't understand all the difficulty of my position there in Petersburg," she added. "Here I'm perfectly at ease and happy.
Well,
all about that later on. Then Sheafsky. He's the marshal of the district, and he's a very good sort of man. But he wants to get something out of Alexei. You understand, with his property, now that we are settled in the country, Alexei can exercise great influence. Then there's Tushkevich. You have seen him, you know, Betsy's admirer. Now he's been thrown over, and he's come to see us. As Alexei says, he's one of those people who are very pleasant if one accepts them for what they try to appear to be.
Then Veslovsky, you know him.
A very nice boy, she said, and a sly smile curved her lips. What's this wild story about him and the Levins?
Veslovsky told Alexei about it, and we don't believe it.
Il est très gentil et naïf, she said, again with the same smile. Men need recreation, and Alexei needs an audience, so I value all these people. We have to have the house lively and gay, so that Alexei may not long for any novelty. Then you'll see the steward, a German, a very good fellow, and he understands his work. Alexei has a very high opinion of him. Then the doctor, a young man, not quite a nihilist, perhaps, but you know, eats with his knife, but a very good doctor. Then the architect, une petite cour.
Chapter 20
Here's Dolly for you, Princess. You were so anxious to see her, said Anna, coming out with Darya Alexandrovna onto the stone terrace, where Princess Varvara was sitting in the shade at an embroidery frame, working at a cover for Count Alexei Kirillovich's easy chair.
She says she doesn't want anything before dinner, but please order some lunch for her, and I'll go and look for Alexei and bring them all in.
Princess Varvara gave Dolly a cordial and rather patronizing reception, and began at once explaining to her that she was living with Anna, because she'd always cared more for her than for her sister, Katerina Pavlovna, the aunt that had brought Anna up, and that now, when everyone had abandoned Anna, she thought it her duty to help her in this most difficult period of transition.
Her husband will give her a divorce, and then I shall go back to my solitude. But now I can be of use, and I'm doing my duty, however difficult it may be for me, not like some other people. And how sweet it is of you, how right of you to have come. They live like the best of married couples. It's for God to judge them, not for us. And didn't Biryuzovsky and Madame Avenyeva, and even Nikandrov and Vasilyev and Madame Mamanova, and Liza Neptunova. No one said a thing against them. And it ended by their being received by everyone. And then, cet homme intérieur, si joli, si comme il faut, tout à fait à l'anglaise. On se réunit le matin au breakfast, et puis on se sépare. Everyone does as he pleases till dinner. Dinner at 7 o'clock. Steva did very well to send you. He needs their support. You know that through his mother and brother he can do anything. And then they do so much good. He didn't tell you about his hospital. Ce sera admirable. Everything from Paris.
Their conversation was interrupted by Anna, who had found the men of the party in the billiard room, and returned with them to the terrace. There was still a long time before the dinner hour. It was exquisite weather, and so several different methods of spending the next 2 hours were proposed. There were very many methods of passing the time at Vozdvizhenskoye, and these were all unlike those in use at Pokrovskoye.
Une partie de lawn tennis, Veslovsky proposed with his handsome smile.
We'll be partners again, Anna Arkadyevna. No, it's too hot. Let us stroll about the garden and have a row in the boat. Show Darya Alexandrovna the river banks,
Vronsky proposed.
I agree to anything, said Sheafsky.
I imagine that what Dolly would like best would be a stroll, wouldn't you? And then the boat, perhaps, said Anna. So it was decided. Veslovsky and Tushkevich went off to the bathing place, promising to get the boat ready and to wait there for them.
They walked along the path in two pairs, Anna with Sheafsky and Dolly with Vronsky. Dolly was a little embarrassed and anxious in the new surroundings in which she found herself. Abstractly, theoretically,
She didn't merely justify, she positively approved of Anna's conduct. As is indeed not infrequent with women of unimpeachable virtue, weary of the monotony of respectable existence, at a distance she not only excused illicit love, she positively envied it. Besides, she loved Anna with all her heart. But seeing Anna in actual life among these strangers with this fashionable tone that was so new to Darya Alexandrovna, she felt ill at ease. What she disliked particularly was seeing Princess Varvara ready to overlook everything for the sake of the comfort she enjoyed. As a general principle, abstractly, Dolly approved of Anna's action. But to see the man for whose sake her action had been taken was distasteful to her. Moreover, she had never liked Vronsky. She thought him very proud, and saw nothing in him of which he could be proud except his wealth. But against her own will, here in his own house, he overawed her more than ever, and she couldn't be at ease with him. She felt with him the same feeling she had had with the maid about her bed-jacket. Just as with the maid she had felt not exactly ashamed, but embarrassed at her patches, so she felt with him not exactly ashamed, but embarrassed. Dolly was ill at ease, and tried to find a subject of conversation. Even though she supposed that through his pride praise of his house and garden would be sure to be disagreeable to him, she did all the same tell him how much she liked his house. "Yes, it's a very fine building, and in the good old-fashioned style," he said. "I so like the court in front of the steps. Was that always so?" "Oh, no," he said, and his face beamed with pleasure. "If you could only have seen that court last spring." And he began, at first rather diffidently, but more and more carried away by the subject as he went on, to draw her attention to the various details of the decoration of his house and garden. It was evident that having devoted a great deal of trouble to improve and beautify his home, Vronsky felt a need to show off the improvements to a new person, and was genuinely delighted at Darya Alexandrovna's praise.
"If you would care to look at the hospital and aren't tired, it's not far. Shall we go?" he said, glancing into her face to convince himself that she wasn't bored. "Are you coming, Anna?" He turned to her.
"We'll come, won't we?" she said, addressing Shavasky.
"Mais il ne faut pas laisser le pauvre Veselovsky et Tuskevich se morfondre là, dans le bateau. We must send and tell them."
"Yes.
This is a monument he will leave behind him," said Anna, turning to Dolly with that sly smile of comprehension with which she had previously talked about the hospital. "Oh, it's a work of real importance," said Shavasky. But to show he wasn't trying to ingratiate himself with Vronsky, he promptly added some slightly critical remarks. "I wonder, though, Count," he said, "that while you do so much for the health of the peasants, you take so little interest in the schools." "C'est devenu tellement comment les écoles," said Vronsky. "You understand that's not the reason. I just got carried away. This way, then, to the hospital," he said to Darya Alexandrovna, pointing to a side path leading out of the avenue. The ladies put up their parasols and turned into the side path. After going down several turnings and going through a little gate, Darya Alexandrovna saw standing on rising ground before her a large, fancy-looking red building, almost finished. The iron roof, which wasn't yet painted, shone with dazzling brightness in the sunshine. Beside the finished building, another had been begun, surrounded by scaffolding. Workmen in aprons, standing on scaffolds, were laying bricks, pouring mortar out of vats, and smoothing it with trowels. "How quickly work gets done with you," said Shavasky. "When I was here last time, the roof wasn't on."
"By autumn it will all be ready. Inside, almost everything is done," said Anna.
"And what's this new building?" "That's the house for the doctor and the dispensary," answered Vronsky, seeing the architect in a short jacket coming toward him, and excusing himself to the ladies, he went to meet him. Going round a hole where the workmen were slaking lime, he stood still with the architect and began talking heatedly.
"The front is still too low," he said to Anna, who had asked him what was the matter.
"I said the foundation ought to be raised," said Anna.
"Yes, of course. It would have been much better, Anna Arkadyevna," said the architect. "But now it's too late."
"Yes, I take an interest in it," Anna answered Shavasky, who was expressing his surprise at her knowledge of architecture. "This new building should have been in harmony with the hospital.
It was an afterthought, and was begun without a plan.
Vronsky, having finished his talk with the architect, joined the ladies and led them inside the hospital. Although they were still at work on the cornices outside and were painting on the ground floor, upstairs almost all the rooms were finished. Going up the broad iron staircase to the landing, they walked into the first large room. The walls were stuccoed to look like marble. The huge plate-glass windows were already in, only the parquet floor wasn't yet finished, and the carpenters, who were planing a square of it, left their work, taking off the bands that fastened their hair, to greet the gentry.
"This is the reception room," said Vronsky. "Here there will be a desk, tables, and benches, and nothing more."
"This way. Let's go in here. Don't go near the window," said Anna, trying the paint to see if it was dry. "Alexei, the paint's dry already," she added.
From the reception room they went into the corridor. Here Vronsky showed them the new system of ventilation he had put in. Then he showed them marble baths and beds with extraordinary spring mattresses. Then he showed them the wards one after another, the storeroom, the linen room, then the modern stoves, then the trolleys which would make no noise as they carried everything needed along the corridors, and many other things. Shavasky, as a connoisseur in the latest mechanical improvements, appreciated everything fully. Dolly simply wondered at all she had not seen before, and anxious to understand it all, made minute inquiries about everything, which gave Vronsky great satisfaction.
"Yes, I imagine that this will be the solitary example of a properly fitted hospital in Russia," said Shavasky.
"And won't you have a maternity ward?" asked Dolly. "That's so much needed in the country. I've often—"
In spite of his usual courtesy, Vronsky interrupted her.
"This is not a maternity home, but a hospital for the sick, and is intended for all diseases except infectious complaints," he said. "Oh, look at this!"
And he rolled up to Darya Alexandrovna a wheelchair that had just been ordered for convalescence.
"Look!"
He sat down in the chair and began moving it.
"The patient can't walk, still too weak, perhaps, or something wrong with his legs. But he must have air, and he moves, rolls himself along."
Darya Alexandrovna was interested in everything. She liked everything very much. But most of all, she liked Vronsky himself, with his natural, simple-hearted eagerness.
"Yes, he's a very nice, good man," she thought several times, not hearing what he said, but looking at him and penetrating into his expression, while she mentally put herself in Anna's place.
She liked him so much just now, with his eager interest, that she saw how Anna could be in love with him. Chapter 21
"No, I think the princess is tired, and horses don't interest her," Vronsky said to Anna, who wanted to go on to the stables where Shavasky wished to see the new stallion. "You go on while I escort the princess home, and we'll have a little talk," he said. "If you would like that," he added, turning to her. "I know nothing about horses, and I shall be delighted," answered Darya Alexandrovna, rather astonished.
She saw by Vronsky's face that he wanted something from her. She wasn't mistaken. As soon as they had passed through the little gate back into the garden, he looked in the direction Anna had taken, and having made sure that she could neither hear nor see them, he began.
"You guess that I've something I want to say to you," he said, looking at her with laughing eyes. "I'm not wrong in believing you to be a friend of Anna's."
He took off his hat, and taking out his handkerchief, he wiped his head, which was growing bald. Darya Alexandrovna made no answer, and merely stared at him with dismay. When she was left alone with him, she suddenly felt afraid. His laughing eyes and stern expression scared her. The most diverse supposition as to what he was about to speak of to her flashed into her brain.
"He's going to beg me to come to stay with them with the children, and I shall have to refuse.
Or to organize a group that will receive Anna in Moscow.
Or isn't it Veslovsky and his relations with Anna? Or perhaps about Kitty, that he feels he was to blame?"
All her conjectures were unpleasant, but she didn't guess what he really wanted to talk about to her.
"You have so much influence with Anna. She's so fond of you," he said. "Do help me."
Darya Alexandrovna looked with timid inquiry into his energetic face, which under the lime trees was continually being lighted up in patches by the sunshine, and then passing into complete shadow again. She waited for him to say more, but he walked in silence beside her, scratching with his stick in the gravel.
"You have come to see us, you, the only woman of Anna's former friends. I don't count Princess Varvara, but I know that you have done this not because you regard our position as normal, but because, understanding all the difficulties of the position, you still love her and want to be a help to her. Have I understood you rightly?" he asked, looking round at her.
"Oh, yes," answered Darya Alexandrovna, shutting her parasol. "But..."
"No," he broke in, and unconsciously, oblivious of the awkward position in which he was putting his companion, he stopped abruptly, so that she had to stop short, too. "No one feels more deeply and intensely than I do the difficulty of Anna's position, and that you may well understand, if you do me the honour of supposing I have any heart, I am to blame for that position, and that is why I feel it."
"I understand," said Darya Alexandrovna, involuntarily admiring the sincerity and firmness with which he said this.
"But just because you feel yourself responsible, you exaggerate it, I'm afraid," she said.
"Her position in the world is difficult, I can well understand." "In the world it is hell," he brought out quickly, frowning darkly. "You can't imagine moral sufferings greater than what she went through in Petersburg those 2 weeks. And I beg you to believe it."
"Yes, but here, so long as neither Anna nor you miss society."
"Society," he said contemptuously. "How could I miss society?"
"So far, and it may always be so, you are happy and at peace."
"I see in Anna that she is happy, perfectly happy.
She has had time to tell me so much already," said Darya Alexandrovna, smiling.
Even so, as she said this, at the same moment a doubt entered her mind whether Anna really was happy.
But Vronsky, it appeared, had no doubts on that score. "Yes, yes," he said. "I know that she is revived after all her suffering. She is happy. She is happy in the present. But I'm afraid of what is before us. I beg your pardon. You would like to walk on?"
"No, I don't mind."
"Well, then, let's sit here."
Darya Alexandrovna sat down on a garden seat in a corner of the avenue. He stood up, facing her.
"I see that she is happy," he repeated.
And the doubt whether she was happy sank more deeply into Darya Alexandrovna's mind.
"But can it last? Whether we have acted rightly or wrongly is another question. But the die is cast," he said, passing from Russian to French. "And we are bound together for life. We are united by all the ties of love that we hold most sacred. We have a child. We may have other children. But the law and all the conditions of our position are such that thousands of complications arise which she doesn't see and doesn't want to see. And that one can well understand, but I can't help seeing them. My daughter is by law not my daughter, but Karenin's." "I cannot bear this deception," he said, with a vigorous gesture of refusal, and he looked with gloomy inquiry towards Darya Alexandrovna. She made no answer, but simply gazed at him. He went on. "One day a son may be born, my son, and he will be legally a Karenin. He will not be the heir of my name or of my property, and however happy we may be in our home life, and however many children we may have, there will be no real tie between us. They will be Karenins. You can understand the bitterness and horror of this position. I've tried to speak of this to Anna. It irritates her. She doesn't understand. And to her I cannot speak plainly of all this. Now, look at another side. I'm happy, happy in her love.
But I must have occupation."
"I've found occupation, and I'm proud of what I'm doing, and consider it nobler than the pursuits of my former companions at court and in the army. And most certainly I wouldn't change the work I'm doing for theirs. I'm working here, settled in my own place, and I'm happy and contented, and we need nothing more to make us happy.
I love my work here.
Ce n'est pas un pis-aller.
On the contrary. Darya Alexandrovna noticed that at this point in his explanation he grew confused, and she didn't quite understand this digression. But she felt that having once begun to speak of matters near his heart, of which he couldn't speak to Anna, he was now making a clean breast of everything, and that the question of his pursuits in the country fell into the same category of matters near his heart as the question of his relations with Anna.
"Well, I will go on," he said, collecting himself. "The important thing is that as I work, I want to have a conviction that what I am doing will not die with me, that I shall have heirs to come after me. And this I have not. Conceive the position of a man who knows that his children, the children of the woman he loves, will not be his, but will belong to someone who hates them and cares nothing about them. It's terrible."
He paused, evidently much moved.
"Yes, indeed, I see that. But what can Anna do?" queried Darya Alexandrovna.
"Yes. That brings me to the object of my conversation," he said, calming himself with an effort. "Anna can. It depends on her.
Even to petition the Tsar for legitimization, a divorce is essential.
And that depends on Anna. Her husband agreed to a divorce. At that time your husband had arranged it completely.
And now I know he wouldn't refuse it. It's only a matter of writing to him. He said plainly at that time that if she expressed the desire, he wouldn't refuse."
"Of course," he said gloomily. "It's one of those pharisaical cruelties of which only such heartless men are capable. He knows what agony any recollection of him must give her. And knowing her, he must have a letter from her. I can understand that it is agony to her. But the matter is of such importance that one must passer par-dessus toutes ces finesses de sentiment. Il y va du bonheur et de l'existence d'Anne et de ses enfants. I won't speak of myself, though. It's hard for me. Very hard," he said, with an expression as though he were threatening someone for its being hard for him. "And so it is, Princess, that I'm shamelessly clutching at you as an anchor of salvation. Help me to persuade her to write to him and ask for a divorce."
"Yes, of course," Darya Alexandrovna said pensively, as she vividly recalled her last interview with Alexei Alexandrovitch. "Yes, of course," she repeated with decision, thinking of Anna. "Use your influence with her. Make her write. I don't like... I'm almost unable to speak about this to her."
"Very well, I will talk to her. But how is it she doesn't think of it herself?" said Darya Alexandrovna. And for some reason, she suddenly, at that point, recalled Anna's strange new habit of half-closing her eyes. And she remembered that Anna drooped her eyelids just when the deeper questions of life were touched upon. "Just as though she half-shut her eyes to her own life, so as not to see everything," thought Dolly.
"Yes, indeed, for my own sake, and for hers, I will talk to her," Dolly said in reply to his look of gratitude. They got up and walked to the house.